This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director, Alicia Graf Mack. Plus, five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
Good morning, I'm Lisa Labas, and this is a special edition of The Rundown. Memorial services for the Reverend Jesse Jackson conclude today. Jackson died in his Chicago home on February 17th. He was 84 years old. He was known as being one of the most visible civil rights leaders of the last half century and a protege of Martin Luther King Jr. Jackson also was a two-time presidential candidate, bringing in about 7 million votes in 1988.
My decision to seek the nomination of the Democratic Party for the presidency of the United States of America.
And here in Chicago, his activism planted seeds for Harold Washington's election as the city's first black mayor in 1983.
I support Harold Washington because he is our Democratic choice.
That paved the way for Barack Obama's presidential nomination in 2008.
With profound gratitude and great humility, I accept your nomination for presidency of the United States.
But Jackson also was a divisive figure, remembered for his larger-than-life personality and sometimes his controversial opinions. WBEZ's Summer Van Benton is here to parse through Jackson's complicated legacy. Hi, Summer.
Hi, thanks for having me. So, Lisa, with a figure as important and influential as Jesse Jackson, it's impossible not to have some controversy. We can't get into everything, but there are three big ones. Jackson had a bit of a divisive approach in how he integrated the media into his work. His views on women's rights were another contentious topic. While he had a lot of women on his team, there were also some allegations of sexism. And we'll also be digging into how Jackson was perceived by the Jewish community. He made some remarks that were subject to a lot of scrutiny over the course of his career.
So, Summer, I want to start with Jackson's relationship with the media. There are a lot of photos and video of Jackson because he was constantly in the press. Can you explain why and how Jackson used the media as a strategic tool?
Yes. So, we're in the 60s. It's the civil rights movement, and activists like Martin Luther King and Jackson understood that media coverage was crucial to pushing the needle forward and moving the civil rights movement forward. We're also living in a season where technology and media were evolving, and so Jackson often used the media to put and shed light on communities, on issues that weren't as discussed or weren't getting the attention that it needed. And by doing so, he was able to advance the Black Liberation Movement. He was able to advance the women's rights movement and other movements during the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, I did see him a lot on local news. That's where I mostly would have seen him. So he's using local news media and national news media, too.
Mm-hmm. He hired Black Press to support his team. That press team's goal was to make sure Jackson got as much coverage as possible and really leaning into this grassroots approach. I got some stories during my reporting where they would be on the road. They would be flying from state to state. Here's one of Jackson's former press secretaries, Delmarie Cobb.
They were flying commercial during the whole campaign. So the reporters who had to cover him were getting on and off the plane and having to catch up with him wherever they could find him. And I would call the stations in the towns we were in, and I would say to the radio stations, would you like 5 minutes with Jesse Jackson? And they would go, 5 minutes with Jesse Jackson? Yes. And so he'd give them 5 minutes, and while he was doing the interview, I was calling the next station, and then he would give them 5 minutes.
Get those eyes on Jackson, as many eyes as possible. So he definitely was intentional about his strategy.
Tell me a little bit about Jackson's neighbor who lived across the street from him.
Jackson's neighbor, Phyllis Brooks Toback, lived directly across the street from Jackson in Chicago. And she told me stories about how there would be press in the lot next door to his home, 24/7 watch. So there'd be trailers in that lot, and there'd be times where she'd be watching the news and she'd look out her window and say, oh my goodness, they're recording. And I'm watching at the same time. So it definitely speaks to how intentional the media was in covering him, but also how intentional his team was in making sure he got those eyes.
But, you know, he was a very handsome and charismatic guy. I mean, even as a high schooler, I remembered him. You know, I knew the minute I heard his voice, that's Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, those speeches, eloquent. He knew how to command a room, and a lot of people were captivated.
We need our jobs. We need our money. We need our protection under the law. Wake up. Blow your trumpet. Let the world know we are displeased. We do not like it. Cut us in.
And you felt that energy. A lot of the people I spoke to, whether they were everyday residents of Chicago or those close to him, they touched on his larger-than-life personality and that aura that resonated. But there were also some individuals who felt like he had an ego, who felt like he was stubborn or arrogant. And sometimes even those close to him would joke about it. But, you know, it wasn't just him wanting to get photo ops and live in this limelight. He used that energy, he used his presence, that fame to shed light on groups that wouldn't normally get the press and the attention if he weren't there.
I mean, yeah, the press came to Rainbow Push all the time for, you know, news spots, for photo ops. So while I think a lot of people used to have to go to wherever the press was, the press came to him.
Yeah, the press would pull up. And it's interesting that you bring up the Rainbow Push Coalition headquarters. When they first founded, they were self-broadcasting. They had a radio station, and they would broadcast those Saturday morning forums, underscoring the importance of the media during those times and sharing what was happening, sharing what was being discussed locally, but also nationally. Let's hear a clip of that.
So we have a right, to fight back. And we intend to start marching on some gun shops to stop the flow of guns where we live.
And eventually, stars, celebrities, politicians would come and attend those meetings and those forums as well.
Yeah, and I think Barack Obama took notice, a young Barack Obama.
Yes, he would go to these forums as well. And sometimes they served as practice because these meetings weren't just kumbaya sessions. You know, they were holding politicians accountable. They were asking questions, getting granular. I think it's important to note that, you know, there was no social media. There weren't any chats. They actually had to come in person and meet to understand how people were feeling and to have those discussions. And even if you go to Rainbow Push today, you go to those Saturday morning forums, they have that same energy.
So there wasn't social media, but there was Sesame Street. And there were adults who were watching Sesame Street with their children. And I remember seeing him on Sesame Street. It was really delightful and powerful.
Yes. And Jackson, that's part of his strategy, right? You can't just go on news channels and speak to those who are tapped into politics, maybe more inclined to tune into the news. He felt it strongly to associate and align himself with culture as well. And he did that by going on SNL during his 1984 campaign.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Going on Sesame Street and connecting with children and uplifting, empowering, and doing things such as sharing his I Am Somebody, you know, speech or poem, as some would refer to it as.
I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be poor. Give a big hand.
He wanted to make sure that he was thinking holistically about media strategy and approach, and going on shows were all part of it.
Yeah. Summer, so you did talk a little bit about some of the criticism he received, that some people said, oh, he's too full of himself. So he received criticism from other people about his press strategy. Were those valid criticisms?
Yeah, it's nuanced. I spoke to a number of his close friends and community members, and they joked about, you know, how much he loved those cameras. They said he was media savvy, how he never met a camera he didn't love. But they also said that there were times where the media maybe didn't depict him in the same light as he actually was as a human, as a man.
And more of a caricature.
More of
times.
A caricature, yes. The medium would frequently make comments about how often Jackson was in front of the cameras. Jackson also received criticism from both the press and the public that he had an ego. Here's one of his former press secretaries, Delmarie Cobb.
I remember an interview that he did, and he said, you know, some people say that you have a big ego, and one of his replies was, it's fine to have a Rolls-Royce ego as long as you don't have a bicycle brain.
Another instance that resurfaces from time to time is how Jackson reacted to Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination immediately after shots were fired. It's been documented that MLK was with Jackson, who was in the parking lot below. Jackson later appeared for days on television in his clothes stained with MLK's blood. That decision sparked some controversy. Was it to get more eyes on Jackson? The media started sensationalizing all kinds of stories. For example, a story started circulating accusing Jackson of intentionally smearing MLK's blood on his shirt. Here's civil rights leader Hosea Williams, who was also with King at the Lorraine Motel when King's assassination took place.
And I realized the only way Jesse could have gotten that blood was stooped out on that floor at the Lorraine Motel and raked that blood off that floor and put that blood on him. I've never respected Jesse since that moment.
Jackson denies it, but the media ran with the story, and at times, so did the public.
Yeah. So he's constantly in the media, but he also didn't shy away from condemning the media's depiction of his character. Tell us about some of the notable moments where Jackson would clash with the media.
Yeah. In the early 2000s, through the Rainbow Push Coalition, he urged media companies and entertainment companies to hire more Black people, more Black women on their teams and on these shows, on these programs. He challenged systemic racism and exclusion in corporate media. We already talked about SNL and Sesame Street. Mm-hmm. Pushing those messages forward in all areas and all channels. And he also pushed Hollywood and the Academy Awards to diversify and hire more Black women. We talk about how at, you know, these Saturday morning forums at Rainbow Push, there were a lot of stars, there were a lot of celebrities, you know, Aretha Franklin, you had Michael Jordan, you had Oprah Winfrey, you had politicians, you know, Al Sharpton. And Jackson tried to, you know, dip his hand in as many buckets as possible for the fight of the people. But you got a lot of those stars and celebrities, actors and actresses, because he was truly trying to push the needle forward from a media and entertainment standpoint.
That almost wraps it up with the media. But what's your big takeaway from Jackson's relationship with the media and how he used it?
When I think about Jackson and his impact, and particularly with the media, I think about how media has evolved, right? Again, Jackson lived in that intersection between King and what we now know as, you know, the modern 20th century. And technology evolves every day. And he took advantage of that ever-evolving technology and those tools. And sometimes it worked for him. Sometimes it worked against him. There's also a lot of racial bias in news and in media. And he challenged it. This also makes me think about Vice President Kamala Harris and some of the critiques that she received. You know, they said she laughed too much. They said her use of social media was a little outrageous, especially when trying to target younger audiences, Gen Z audiences. But she is a representation of how media and technology has evolved. And I think generally Black leaders are often scrutinized, not just for what they say, but how they say it, whether it's their tone, their posture, their facial expression, their ambition. And so it's not a far-fetched concept.
Let's move on to a more complicated topic. He had allegations of sexism against him, and some women were critical of Jesse Jackson's perspectives on feminism and women's rights. Explain some of those criticisms.
There were multiple points in his career where people accused him of being sexist. He received some criticism for not prioritizing women's rights or gender equality during his 84 and 88 presidential campaigns. Not as much as, you know, like maybe racial equality or economic justice. Some also criticized his perspective on abortion, especially with the development of Roe v. Wade in the 70s. When the Roe v. Wade decision paved the way for legal abortion in the U.S., Jackson was against the procedure at first. He talked about it very openly and clearly and communicated the struggle as a Baptist pastor, his religious perspectives on Roe v. Wade, and how that kind of contradicted with his moral and political perspectives as well.
And you spoke with one historian about Jackson's views on abortion. What did she have to say?
I spoke with a historian, Barbara Ransby, who would often talk to Jackson about how his perspective kind of stood and evolved and some of the comments he publicly made on Roe v. Wade. And I think that is also an interesting area in which we saw humility come forth. Let's listen to that now.
Over the years, he's come to accept a woman's right to choose and support a woman's right to choose whether she will have a child or not. I think him personally, he still has a position that, you know, it's inconsistent with his faith. But I appreciate that kind of evolution.
We saw him just as a man change his mind, change his perspective. And ultimately what he determined is that while religiously he was unsettled, mm-hmm. politically, there shouldn't be a rule mandating whether or not a woman can or cannot have an abortion, which is nuanced. It's challenging, especially for clergy, Black conservative clergy.
So talk a little bit more about some of the women in his direct circle. Did they feel Jackson was sexist, and what kind of leadership roles were they playing?
Yeah. When I began reporting on Jackson, I noticed that a lot of the sources that I had spoken to were women. And I think that's reflective of how strongly he prioritized and felt about the contributions of women in the greater fight. But it wasn't just Jackson. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of civil rights leaders who noticed how women functioned and worked within the Black church, how they were secretaries, how they were, you know, keeping the books, how they were treasurers, and they were keeping the operations of the Black church. And as a Black pastor, he pulled and called on a lot of those Black women to come and support him in his campaigns and in his fights. But they were never the face.
Right.
They were the ones who were, you know, on their secretary team. They were going into stores for Operation Breadbasket, for example. They were going into the stores and checking the meat, checking the produce, and seeing in, you know, on the South and West Side neighborhoods whether they were quality or not. If you look at older pictures and you look at the picketing photos and the boycotts, you'll notice a lot of Black women. I think a really interesting quote from Jeanette Wilson. I think I asked her, are there any photos or videos of your time working with Jackson? And she was like, no, girl, like we were working, we were picketing, we were busy fighting and pushing the movement forward. Let's listen to that now.
I traveled with Reverend Jackson to Mississippi. I just got out of law school, so I was carrying all kinds of books because we were going there on a voting rights tour. First of all, it's heavy. I didn't have a rolling bag. I had to yell at him. He's at the other end of the airport. I'm like, hey, I can't carry this. And I thought I had to look up the law while I was there. So there have just always been women who have led many aspects of the movement. Didn't get all the books about them because we don't take time to write. We just keep doing what we do.
And there were just all of these interesting stories about how he called on the women in the church. He called on women in these powerful spaces to support him in his campaign.
So, Summer, let's pivot a little bit. I want to talk about Jackson's relationship with the Jewish community. That relationship was pretty frictious at times. Can you speak a little bit about how he was perceived in that community?
Mm-hmm. So during his 1984 campaign, there was actually a moment where he was having a conversation with a colleague who was a reporter, and he used an offensive term to describe the Jewish community in New York. That was during his 1984 presidential campaign, and it brought a lot of backlash and hurt a lot of those in the Jewish community. Some saw it as a mistake that he was able to bounce back from, but others, it left a sour mark. Next, I would point out his relationship and dynamic with Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan. Farrakhan was accused of being anti-Semitic because of things he said over the years, something he denies. And Jackson's proximity to Farrakhan caused a lot of concern in the Jewish community. Jackson was also a vocal supporter of Palestinian statehood.
Just and lasting peace is inextricably bound for a state for Palestinian people. and the recognition of the PLO as the government in exile with which our nation must negotiate.
All of these things kind of put a dent in his relationship with some in the Jewish community.
What helped to heal that relationship with the Jewish community, if anything did?
Yeah. Jackson would meet with Jewish leaders, rabbis. He'd make public apologies. As it relates to Farrakhan, Jackson would publicly disagree with the Nation of Islam sentiments about the Jewish community. And to some, this was a hard road bump to bounce back from. The damage politically was significant, especially in New York. You know, those comments were made during his 1984 run. And so I heard from Delmarie Cobb that a lot of his time in towards his 1988 presidential run was spent trying to apologize and trying to meet with leaders and bounce back from those comments.
I want to head back to his neighbor, Phyllis Brooks Toback. You spoke with her. She's Jewish. She went to the same seminary as the Reverend Jackson, although at a different time. What was her perspective on this issue? What did she tell you?
Yeah, so, you know, Brooks Toback was actually Jackson's neighbor between 1974 and 2016 when her husband passed away. And so her boys and Jackson's boys would shoot hoops together. They'd play basketball together.
Like kids do.
Like kids. And so overall, she thought Jackson was a good man who wanted to make a good impact and cared deeply about people and about issues. She said that there's a mutual kinship and mistrust between the Jewish and Black community. But at the end of the day, she felt that a lot of Jews, quote, appreciated and had an admiration for what he was doing. End quote.
So tell me a little bit, what do you think? Was Jackson ultimately a unifier or a divider? Or, you mm-hmm. know, is it more complicated than that?
Yeah. A lot of people would say Jackson built his entire legacy on unification. In my conversation with Barbara Ransby, she said, you know what, Summer, Jackson was a unifier. He wasn't the unifier. Yeah. And I think that's important to note because he wasn't the only activists. He wasn't the only one fighting for the progress of people.
He couldn't be.
There's no possible way, even though it feels like he's lived a million lives. But during the 60s, there were so many groups who didn't necessarily see eye to eye on a world scale. But even here in Chicago, whether it be, you know, the Young Lords or the NAACP, the Urban League, Latino communities, LGBTQ communities, the list goes on. But he took the Rainbow Coalitions off of the backbones of Fred Hampton and founded the organization, what we now know as the Rainbow Push Coalition. And it's really centered on bringing people together so that we can get on the same page. And a lot of times what they found is that we all want the same thing. We just may have different approaches to getting to that unified goal. He used this analogy of a quilt a lot of times, and you'll hear it throughout some of his speeches.
He gave the speech at the DNC in 1984.
Yes, yes, in which he talked about this quilt analogy.
America's more like a quilt. Many patches, many pieces, many colors, many sizes, all woven and held together by a common thread.
Barbara Ransby and I talked about it again as well. And she was telling me how, you know, we all might be small fragments of this quilt. We might be a little bitty patch. We might be the thread. But when we come together, everybody's warm. And he genuinely felt that. And it showed up in times where he would go and protest with a group of five people who were advocating for something, maybe a union group. Maybe it was a larger protest with thousands or millions of people. But one common theme that I saw is that he showed up, no matter how big or how small, and he cared genuinely about people. He didn't always get it right, but he tried, and he was willing to take the critique, willing to take the feedback. And I agree with Ransby in that, you know, he was an imperfect man, but he was a principled man, and he cared about bringing people together. And the last thing I'll say is during the press conference that his children held, when note that they were very adamant about underscoring is this deep care for unification that their father had, that he wanted his homegoing services to be a great meeting And he wanted, if anything, people to come together, whether they were on the left, the right, whether they were conservative, liberal, Democratic, Republican, no matter where they stood, he wanted them to come together and let this be a catalyst for a meeting of differences. And so I think back to MLK's assassination and the impact that had on the nation, on the world, in the same way that Jackson and Ralph Abernathy and others kind of picked up the reins. I hope it almost serves as a catalyst for reunification in ways where we see a lot of divisiveness.
We're going to leave it there. That's WBEZ's Summer Van Benton. And we've been talking about the Reverend Jesse Jackson's legacy and multifaceted life. Thanks, Summer.
You're welcome.
To catch up on all the latest news about the Reverend Jesse Jackson, you can visit our website at WBEZ.org. You can stay tuned to 91.5 FM for more updates there. Today's episode was produced and mixed by Minju Park. It was edited by Miriam Kramer, Katie O'Connell, Alexandra Solomon, and Alden Lowry. I'm Lisa Lavis. Thanks for listening.